You're listening to the show that talks about stuff the others can't, don't, or won't. The Drew Marshall Show on Joy 1250.
Well, Ken Lanning is currently a consultant in the area of crimes against children. He was a special agent with the FBI for more than 30 years before he retired in 2000. He's been involved in the professional study of the criminal aspects of deviant sexual behavior since 1973. He specialized in the study of the sexual victimization of children after being transferred to the FBI Academy in Quantico, Virginia in 1981. He was assigned to the Behavioral Science Unit, then the Missing and Exploited Children's Task Force, and then the National Center for the Analysis of Violent Crime. He is a founding member of the Board of Directors, the American Professional Society on the Abuse of Children. He's also a current member of the Advisory Board of the Association for the Treatment of Sexual Abusers. I'd like you to welcome to the show Mr. Ken Lanning. Thank you for your time, sir.
Thank you.
Well, you have been in the media a lot over the years, and I guess one of the things right off the bat is that 92 article of yours, which I guess people are still using today in many trial situations.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly. All I know is it's all over the internet. I wrote it and targeted and intended it primarily to be used by investigators and prosecutors, but a lot of people have picked up on it and it's been disseminated, and it's all over on various sites on the internet, and I hope people can get something useful out of it, or at least make people think.
Well, I have. I've been reading a lot of documentation online recently that you have been involved with, Ken, and I've just got to say right off the bat, well done. I always appreciate when someone takes their job seriously and when they're very professional and follow-up leads, just not on hearsay. You are a very, very thorough investigator.
Well, that's an important aspect of all of this. I believe that what I tried to say in this material, this is from an investigative perspective, and I believe that the investigative perspective has to be one of objective fact-finding. That's what it's all about. And so from when I'm doing my job as an investigator, I try as much as possible. I am a human being. I have weaknesses, but as much as possible, I try to be an objective fact finder and go where the evidence leads me.
Well, a 30-year veteran of the FBI, and we just got off the phone with a gentleman by the name of Steve Crisp. He's the father of a missing boy from Barrie, Ontario. His 15-year-old son has been missing for 3 weeks after they sort of had a fight about the Xbox, you know, a typical family fight. And this is an online game, an online community, and that sort of thing. And they're just wondering about foul play now. And, you know, I hesitate asking you this right off the bat here, but as a 30-year veteran, having studied what you studied in the FBI, you know, what comes to mind or what would you say to Mr. Crisp? I mean, is it as crass as 3 weeks? Boy, that's a long period of time. Online gaming, I've seen lots of stuff to suggest foul play. I mean, is there any hope for this family?
Absolutely. There's a great deal of confusion about this because there was a study in the United States that found when children are abducted and murdered, they're usually murdered pretty quickly within 3 hours. But what many people don't realize, the study doesn't say that when children are abducted, they're murdered within 3 hours. It says when they're abducted and murdered. So many people get confused by that study. What many people don't know is the fact of the matter is that the research tells us that 99% of children who are abducted are returned relatively unharmed a short time later. Now, the longer the child is missing, the greater the chance there's some kind of foul play. But an important thing that the father needs to understand is that with a 15-year-old boy, what we do know with certainty is that the boy is missing. We have to think about he could be missing for a lot of reasons. He could have run away. He could have gone off with some friends. Any number of things. He could be lost, injured. But he could have been abducted. And if he was abducted, he could be abducted for a variety of different reasons. In today's world, there's almost a common assumption that if someone's missing, they were abducted. If they were abducted, they were abducted by a sexual pervert, and the sexual pervert's going to kill them. There are cases where that happens, but that's not the typical scenario. And no matter what the statistical odds are, no matter what the research told us, what law enforcement has to do, and certainly what a father is going to do, is to keep hope alive and do everything they can to keep searching for as long as it takes until they find out what happened.
I appreciate those words, and I'm trying to separate your interview with the interview I just did with Mr. Crisp because they are definitely unrelated. I had you booked for a lot of weeks here, And I just recently have been hearing about this new in the news, and I just thought, I've got to get Mr. Crisp on the show. We've got to get our listeners praying for this family. So it is completely unrelated. I don't know how else better to separate this, because I don't want the family or anybody else thinking that we're connecting these two stories. The background you have, Ken, is you spent years investigating the abuse of children, and part of that investigational stuff that you've been through is satanic ritual abuse. And that phrase in and of itself sends shivers down people's spine, and it reminds people of the days of Mike Warnke, I think was his name, and he wrote a book called, was it Satan Seller or something like that. And there was a lot of hype in the 80s.
Right.
How in the world did you begin to investigate satanic ritual abuse?
Well, it's an important point. The question that you asked me about the situation with Mr. Chris Boy is actually something that I deal with far more often and more commonly. My main area of expertise is crimes against children, sexual victimization of children, missing children. That's what I know the most about. That was the area that I focused on. And starting in some time, and I don't know the exact date because I never realized the significance of it at the time, but somewhere around the early 1983 or so, I began to hear with increasing frequency stories that children were being sexually victimized, and to make a long story short, it appeared or sounded like this victimization was being perpetrated by organized satanic cults. And I realized that in order for me to evaluate these allegations, I had to learn more about Satanism and the occult and cults and all the rest of this stuff, more than what I learned in my 16 years of Christian education and so on. So I embarked upon a self-education project, which the FBI supported and allowed me to do, and tried to learn everything I could so that I could objectively evaluate these cases. And part of my role in the behavioral science unit was to do training, to do research, but also we had this component of operational assistance or consultation. Many people know it by the term profiling. So I was getting called on more and more of these cases. So my role in these cases was not to jump in a helicopter and run out and personally investigate them, but to consult on them, to work with the investigators, whether they were state, local police, FBI, federal police, prosecutors, and try to assist them and guide them and use my expertise and knowledge in these cases to assist them in trying to find out what was going on in these cases. And so that's how I got involved in this. And it was a long process as I began to study and evaluate these cases and gradually began to come to some conclusions about what might be going on.
Well, we'll talk about those conclusions in a second, but I just want to set this up properly here. www.rickross.com is a website that has a lot of interesting material on there. And here's a blurb from one of the articles I read. And bear with me, folks. This is a bit of a shocker of a paragraph here. A young teenage girl impregnated during a satanic ritual is forcibly delivered of her nearly term baby, forced to ritually kill the child and then to cannibalize its heart as cult members watch. Another girl, a small child, is sealed inside the cavity of a disemboweled animal and rebirthed by her cultic captors during a ceremony. A preschool class is systematically sexually, emotionally, and physically abused by part of a nationwide, nearly invincible network of satanic pedophiles and pornographers. A young girl is thrown into an electrified cage with wolves and ritually tortured to deliberately produce a wolf personality, part of her multiple personality disorder. This is the kind of stuff that was being talked about back then.
Absolutely. And those are the kinds of cases where my telephone was more likely to ring. When police officers and prosecutors were dealing with more, and I hate to use this word when talking about the abuse of children, but more typical kinds of cases that they were used to dealing with day in and day out, they knew how to handle them. They tended to reach out to the FBI and the behavioral science unit when they had these more bizarre type cases. So cases like you just described were very typical of the kinds of phone calls that I would get where an investigator would say, little children at a daycare center are alleging this. We just had an adult survivor come in and tell us that a year ago, 6 years ago, 9 years ago, 20 years ago, they were in a cult and all the kinds of things that you just described were going on. They were breeding babies, sacrificing them, eating them, and all the rest of this stuff. So these are very typical in my world, although they're horrifying to most people. These are the kinds of cases that I was hearing about day in and day out. And therefore, I began to assist law enforcement to investigate these cases. And one of the things I quickly realized is that if people were doing the kinds of things that you just described, there would almost always have to be some kind of corroborative evidence left behind. And a key phrase that you used and kind of glossed over is very significant here, when the individual said, nearly invincible, because that became a key element. In order to maintain this belief that all of this was going on, in the absence of corroborative evidence that should have been there, you have to believe that these people are superhuman, that they have a characteristic that I've never seen in human beings, and that is they never make a mistake. And so all human beings make mistakes. You cannot do the kinds of things that you just described to me and not leave evidence behind. And so what became most significant to me as these cases were pursued to varying degrees, and I will freely admit some of them were dismissed as nonsense, some of them were slightly investigated, but many of them were aggressively investigated, and I defy anyone to say what more law enforcement could have done. And in the course of those investigations, almost none of the kinds of extreme things that you just described could ever be documented. Sometimes you find there were individuals who had weird beliefs, who had abused children, but this idea of murdering and drinking their blood and eating their flesh and intergenerational cults and infiltrating daycare centers, making snuff films and all the rest of this stuff, that was the part of it that there was almost no documentation of.
Well, let's talk about maybe a couple of stories, scenarios that you investigated. Something that comes to the top of my brain is the McMartin Preschool in Manhattan Beach, California.
Right, and that was one of the kind of landmark cases. These cases tended to grow out of four major scenarios, and one of the four major scenarios was the daycare scenario. This was being alleged by young children. When I say young, these children were usually 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years of age, alleging that this group, appearing to be some type of organized satanic cult, had infiltrated the daycare center to ritually abuse these children and win new disciples for Satan and all the rest of it. And the most famous or well-known of all those cases was the McMartin daycare case.
Well, because apparently there were 350 pupils claiming this sort of stuff was going on.
Yes. Eventually, when these interviews were being done, I think over a year period of time, somewhere around approximately 300 children were interviewed who made varying kinds of disclosures concerning how they were abused at the daycare center.
Was there corroborative evidence? Were there stories similar? Because this is what I've heard, that it's amazing. This has to be happening because 300 children were interviewed and the stories just seem to be the same.
Well, just to make a long story short, and not without focusing just on that one case,
right,
that's a good example of it, but what I discovered as I began to look at this phenomenon and began to say, why aren't we finding corroborative evidence? Why are we not discovering the clear corroborative proof that this is going on? And when I began to wonder that, there were four questions that immediately came to my mind. I'm not a fool. I'm not an idiot. And I began to ask myself, if this doesn't seem, and I'll use that word now, seem to be going on, why are these children alleging it, or these adult survivors, whoever they are? Where are they getting the details from? Why is there a similarity to their story? Why are 300 children telling a very similar story? And the fourth question is actually the most intriguing and interesting one, is why do so many people believe it? I've talked to many extremely intelligent, highly educated people who believe that this is going on. So I can assure you that I asked myself those four questions. And what I discovered is there are answers to those four questions as to why 300 children interviewed in the year following these allegations could make these allegations without them being necessarily, in the word I prefer to use, accurate. And one of the, without spending the time, we don't have the time to go into every possibility here, and I'm not saying this is a simple answer.
No.
But one of the things that was clearly identified, especially for the young children, was the issue of leading, suggestive, and repetitive questions. And so what we began to learn in these cases is something that's now applied almost across the board in the investigation of all these kinds of cases, whether there's a ritual element or not. We have to be careful about leading and suggestive interviewing and repetitive interviewing. And we find out that if you have a preconceived idea, a confirmation bias, as it's called, and go into this, what we discovered in looking at many of these interviews, all these children were simply doing is confirming what somebody was feeding to them. And so it's really not as bizarre or as unusual as you think as to how 300 children could be telling a similar story. The other thing we have to realize is that much of what's being described here is part of a shared cultural myth or belief system. Just to use one analogy, and again, none of these are perfect analogies, but if you were interviewed little children all over the United States and Canada about the boogeyman under their bed, they would all describe it in similar ways. They would know how to defend against this guy. Many little children have the shades in their room pulled all the way down so there's no light coming in. And the main protective element against this boogeyman under your bed is your blanket that you get under.
Mm-hmm.
Yet there is no boogeyman under your bed. And yet there's a shared kind of cultural belief that comes from somewhere that people have. So much of what these people describe is the belief of what it is that supposedly these evil forces are doing. And one of the interesting things that I observed over the years is when you look at this claim of so-called satanic crime or satanic ritual abuse, Satanists always seem to be accused of two kinds of crimes. One is extreme violence, and the other is sexual deviancy.
Right.
You don't hear a lot about satanic bank fraud and embezzlement, satanic pollution, and other kinds of things. If Satanists are evil, they should be doing a wide, diverse set of things. But what I came to realize is that the term satanic is very often applied to crimes that we can't understand. The motivation just seems so weird. Why would somebody mutilate a body and cut it up? Why would somebody engage in these bizarre sexual perversions, such as having sex with a three-year-old child? And because we can't understand it, it's easier to begin to suggest that this is somehow the work of the devil. And I can understand how spiritually somebody might be led to that. I also believe that spiritually you can believe that all crime is caused by evil and all crime is caused by Satan, all evil is caused by Satan. But that serves no value in investigating these cases for law enforcement. And the key thing here is to very often try to pin down, and this is something that I tried to do, what exactly is Satanism? And in the course of my research, I discovered something very sad and startling to me, and that is that for most people, they have a simple definition of Satanism, and that is it's any belief system other than mine. And one of the things that was most shocking to me is I went to a conference for law enforcement, and a book was recommended to read to understand Satanists, and I got the book and I read it, and there was a chapter in there entitled, Is Roman Catholicism Witchcraft?
Wow.
And the answer was yes.
Oh. Was this at the SMART conference?
No, it wasn't at the SMART. This was years ago.
Oh, okay.
This was many years ago. This was, again, in the time frame we're talking about when there was a kind of almost hysteria over this in the United States. We're talking about here in the mid-1980s. And so when I went to this conference, and I thought, wait, because I happen to be a Roman Catholic, and that's my background, and then I began to hear and find literature that suggested that the Pope was the Antichrist and on.
Sure.
And I began to realize that a lot of this is a kind of religious view. And so during the Crusades, we had two armies moving across the field of battle, each screaming death to the infidel. And in the belief of some individuals, the United States is the great Satan, and we believe they're Satan. And so a lot of this is a religious view. And what, coming back to what we talked about at the very beginning, I came to the realization that I was had to take a law enforcement perspective. And that law enforcement perspective had to be this. It certainly is possible that a spiritual belief system can play a role in the commission of a crime. That role is usually either to facilitate or enhance the commission of the crime or to rationalize and justify the commission of the crime. But from a law enforcement point of view, it really doesn't make any difference what the spiritual belief system is. It could be Christianity, any number of different denominations. It could be Hindus, Muslims, Satanists, Hare Krishnas, whatever it is. It doesn't matter. The religion may have played a role in it, and what I discovered is that religion and spiritual belief can play a role in the commission of crimes, but this is not limited to Satanists. And because Satanists, whatever they may be, are actually a very small number of people, the vast majority of crimes, crimes that are committed with a spiritual component to them, have nothing to do with Satanism.
Well, it would be amazing, I'm sure, in your investigations, how many so-called Christians committed similarly heinous crimes.
Well, exactly right. In my publication, for example, I listed things such as parents defy a court order and send their children to an unlicensed Christian school. Parents refuse to send their children to any school because they're waiting for the second coming of Christ. Parents beat their child to death because he or she is not following their Christian belief. parents violate child labor laws because they believe the Bible requires such work. Individuals bomb an abortion clinic or kidnap a doctor. I've also been involved in many cases where a child molester is molesting children and reading to them from the Bible as evidence that this is what God wants, that you have to obey your father and do what your father wants. So all of these are examples of how people can use religion. I'm not suggesting and I'm not blaming Christianity for any of these things. I'm simply saying that people can use any spiritual belief system to justify a crime or to facilitate and enhance the crime. And as an investigator, that can become an important thing to be aware of. But it simply doesn't make any difference which spiritual belief system
is. Well, look, Ken, 30 years in with the FBI, how did you not turn into a pessimistic, cynical jerk?
Well, that's an excellent question. And actually, in many ways, it's a very significant question, because when I tell people that I've been studying the sexual victimization of children for over 35 years, people say, how could you have lasted that long? Why didn't you burn out? How could you do it? And I suppose the real honest answer is, I don't know. I could have, and I've seen people that has happened to, but I'd like to believe that I'd monitor myself, and I got to that point, I would have gotten out of the work. But somehow, my personality allowed me to stay in this kind of work, to look at it in a professional way. And I don't want to compare myself to other disciplines, but it's no different from a doctor who treats pediatric cancer or an undertaker who deals with people who die.
Yeah.
You have to find some way to isolate the emotion of it, to kind of have one step removed to look at it objectively, to have strong feelings that the work is important and worthwhile, but not to get emotionally caught up in every single case.
Sure. I mean, Ken, you must be good at compartmentalization. I grew up in the funeral business myself, so I understand what you're talking about.
Right, exactly right. And the interesting thing about it is, one of the reasons I wrote the publication that you described earlier and publicly spoke out about this, and as a result of that, I took a great deal of abuse and attacks, and many people didn't like what I was saying. But I tried to explain to people that the reason that I took this approach is not because I was trying to become some apologist for Satanists and so on. It's because I was trying to preserve the reality of child abuse and child sexual abuse, because I realized when these cases come along today, and it's very interesting that I ask classes now all the time, how many of you have heard of the McMartin daycare case? And what's very interesting, in 2008, less than a quarter of the people in the room have ever even heard of the case. But I tell them that whether you've heard of it or not, it has affected your life. And even today, when you have a case and you're prosecuting a case of child abuse and somebody says, well, if it didn't happen, why would the child say it? And then the defense attorney or the defendant will say, haven't you heard of the McMartin case? So to this day, it is still pointed to, in cases like that, pointed to try to minimize the idea of these allegations and the idea that this is a real thing. And therefore, I recognize that if we couldn't understand what was going on and find better ways to evaluate valid and invalid cases, that all of this was going to fuel what's known as the backlash and destroy the credibility and the reality of victimization of children. And so that's why, because I did believe this was an important issue and I was concerned about abused children and devoted my professional life to it, that's why I decided that I had to speak out of this. And the interesting thing about it is that as I talked to many people about this, I met a lot of Christians who had the same point of view. They said that this kind of hysteria is going to give Christianity a bad name.
Sure.
And I met therapists who said this kind of hysteria is going to give therapy a bad name.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I had Mike Warnke on the show last Halloween.
Right.
And you know Mike Warnke.
I know who he is, yes.
Yeah, the author of The Satan Cellar. Right. And, of course, I think his book spun this hysteria in the evangelical scene right out of control. It was a huge contributor.
His was a big one amongst that area, discipline. Another book that came from another man who happens to be from Canada.
Sorry about that.
Well, no. Listen. The primary pushers of this hysteria were Americans. There's no doubt about it.
Okay. All right.
Some Canadians played a role in it, but the primary pushers of this internationally all over the world were the United States. We sent our quote-unquote experts all over the world to uncover this. But anyway, one individual in the early 80s who began a lot of this amongst what's called the adult survivors was Dr. Lawrence Pozzo, a psychiatrist who wrote the book Michelle Remembers.
Oh, right.
And that was the story of this woman that was a patient of his who recovered memories. And that's, I mentioned earlier the scenarios. The one scenario we've been talking about is daycare, but another major scenario is what's called adult survivors. These are usually individuals, sometimes men, but far more often women, who now are in their late teens, early 20s, 30s, 40s, and now recover these memories of these horrible things that happened to them when they were little children. And so his book played a big role amongst mental health professionals. And so whatever discipline you're talking about, certain publications can play a role in it. But I think it would be overly simplistic to just simply suggest that any one individual or any one book did this.
Yeah.
What I began to realize is this became an interesting phenomenon because, as I told you earlier, I had these four questions. And the one I became most intrigued by, and still am intrigued by, is the fourth question. And that is, if a lot of this really isn't going on, and there's no real evidence of it, why are there so many intelligent, educated, rational people who believe that it is? Because I met many people. Dr. Lawrence Pozzo, who I believe now is deceased, but I met him when he was alive and I talked to him. He's one of the most intelligent human beings I ever met. Brilliant.
Really?
And when analyzing any case other than this one, he was highly skeptical about all of it. And so you begin to look and you'd say, I kept asking myself, wait a second, these people are smarter than I am. Why is it that they can't see this? They can't evaluate this? And gradually what I came to believe and realize is that adult human beings tend to believe what they want or need to believe, and the greater the need, the greater the tendency. And so what a lot of this was all about was a need to believe. And what I discovered for many people in my field of child sexual abuse, they needed to believe children. Your life is much simpler if you say, I just believe anything the kid tells me. If the child begins to tell you things that didn't happen, this begins to make your life real complicated because now you have to figure out some way to sort through this. But with dealing with people who are looking at this primarily from a religious or Christian perspective, what I discovered for many of them, finding proof of the work of Satan validates their belief system.
Right,
because
right.
Because if there's a Satan, then there has to be a God. And so a lot of this is a need to see the hand of Satan in these crimes, and this somehow validates their religious belief system. And I fully understand that. And I'm not saying that that's a bad thing.
No, no.
I'm just saying that's a human trait that can affect why you believe this. And so what I began to realize is that I had to try to find ways to separate out my religious belief from this and try to look at this as an objective fact-finding investigator.
But, you know, Ken, summing this up, basically, bottom line is, all of these claims of satanic ritual abuse over the years, thoroughly investigated, came to the conclusion, really, there's a lot of weird people involved in all sorts of religious circles. But when it comes to these great, grandiose claims of satanic ritual abuse and conspiracy theories and 300 kids, this, that, and the other thing, it's just not real.
Right. And so what's important here is to understand there is no shortage of horror in the world and terrible things. Children being abused in all kinds of ways. People say to me all the time now when they come to me, they say, Ken, have you ever found a documented case of satanic ritual abuse? And I say, well, describe what you mean. How would you define ritual abuse? And if they say to me it's the work of an intergenerational, transgenerational cult that does this to comply with their rituals and ceremonies, I say, no, I haven't seen such a case. But if you're talking about cases in which human beings do horrible, terrible things, abusive things to children, including mutilate them and cutting them up and so on, have I seen documented cases of that? Absolutely.
Sure, sure.
But I haven't seen any evidence that this is the work of some kind of secretive, underground, intergenerational satanic cult that's doing this to comply with their religious beliefs.
Well, that's just because you're probably a Satanist who works for the FBI.
Well, yeah. And the interesting thing is what I took a certain amount, although those kinds of statements bother me and they affect me because I'm a human being, but one of the things that I've taken great pride in is that those people who believe that these allegations of satanic abuse were part of a mass hysteria have blamed me for creating that hysteria because I wrote articles about child sex rings and child pornography and so on. So the people who believed that this was all hysteria blame me. And then the people who thought it was all going on, they also blame me, believing that I was part of some cover-up and so on. So when I realized that I was being attacked by both extremes, that began to tell me that I was probably on the right track.
You're on the right track.
Right.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, a final word of advice for the evangelicals today who once, I don't know, maybe they tracked with the Mike Warnke stuff, or they, you know, they grew up in the 80s as Jesus people, and they remember that big hysteria and hype about satanic ritual abuse. What do you say to the evangelical community today, Ken?
What I say to them is that, as I said before, I have no problem if they want to believe that evil things in the world are the work of the devil and that spirituality is important. All of that I tend to agree with from my religious perspective. But if you're going to allege that these people, and you're going to label their crimes with this name and suggest that they're part of some intergenerational thing, what this is going to do is to destroy your credibility. It's going to be embarrassing when you go down that road. You certainly have the right to go down that road. You have the right to believe anything you want, but I think it's going to take you in the wrong direction, and you're going to overlook a lot of real stuff that's going on, and you're going to pursue a lot of stuff that isn't going on simply because you need to view it in a certain kind of a way. And I just think that that's somewhat unfortunate, because there's no shortage of evil in the world. There's no shortage of bad things that happen to children that I've devoted my life to. But seeing it in this somewhat simplistic kind of way doesn't do any good, and very often invalidates cases and fuels something called the backlash. People who want to minimize the abuse of children, or people who want to ridicule Christianity, you're giving them the ammunition to do it.
Exactly. Well, especially considering where the source comes from and where the source's source came from. I mean, you were talking to me when we were talking last week about the fact that people are teaching this in various courses, and when you challenge them on where they're getting their information, a lot of it is basically media reports been fueled by other media reports.
Right. In other words, that's one of the things, when those questions that I mentioned earlier, well, if this didn't happen, where are they getting the details from?
Yeah.
Well, I discovered there's a whole industry of this. There's books that were written about this, and to some sad extent, a certain amount of what Satanists do is a self-fulfilling prophecy, because what you discover is that if you got people who were willing to come forward and tell you, and there are people who will say, I am a Satanist. And then you say, oh, well, you were raised in a cult for the last 20 generations? No, I was raised in this denomination or that denomination. My mother and father were Baptists, Presbyterians, Catholics, whatever they were. Many of these people gravitated towards this sometime in their adolescent years. And you say, when you decided to become a Satanist, how did you figure out what Satanists do? Well, I went and got this book. And what I discovered is, when you trace this back, what it is that Satanists do has always been defined by the anti-Satanists. They took a lot of activity which was pagan, which, depending on your view of all of this, really isn't the same as Satanism, but they looked at certain behaviors and labeled it as satanic and said, this is what Satanists do. And then what happened is, once you say that's what they do, people who wanted to be Satanists then did that.
That's right.
So it became a self-fulfilling prophecy. So you begin to adapt those things and engage in those kinds of behaviors. So that's somewhat unfortunate, that a lot of this material that's being spread is just the myth and legend of what this is supposedly is going on. And so a lot of this information was disseminated to individuals and then used it to validate cases that really couldn't be validated. There are individuals who dabble in this stuff, and they just kind of invent it as they go along. Most of these people read a couple of pages of this book, they go to a couple of movies, they do this, and what it really comes down to is what I said earlier, they're just looking for something to rationalize and justify their behavior. So there may be a satanic calendar or something out there. They're going to commit their crimes on the days they feel like committing them, and if they can find a holiday that goes with it, that's fine, but that's not really why they committed the crime.
Ken Lanning, former FBI agent investigating satanic ritual abuse claims over the years, you have been one of my favorite guests. I have absolutely, thoroughly enjoyed listening to you today. Thank you very, very much. Coming up in about a half an hour, we're going to speak with a fellow by the name of John D. Ali, otherwise known as Lord Egan from the First Church of Satan. I'm not sure if you've ever had any dealings with him.
I don't know him specifically, no.
No, well, he's one of the world's foremost Satanists. So we're going to chat with him about some things, but before we do that, we're going to go to our callers. We're going to ask them this question. I want you to answer this just real quick answer. A man wants to know if anyone has ever encountered any form of supernatural evil, like demons, not just people claiming to be evil, but a real, live, genuine encounter with, say, like an evil spirit. Ken, have you ever experienced that?
Well, that's the kind of thing that it's a very subjective thing. In other words, this is where we have to make a distinction here between that which is clearly documented and that which you believe.
Exactly.
And obviously, religiously, I believe a lot of things that I can't really prove. They're matters of faith.
Sure.
So once you start to talk about these supernatural things, then those are matters of faith.
But have you ever experienced something like that?
I personally, other than more subtle kinds of things, I have experienced in my own life what I consider to be the hand of God, but not like I was talking to him and he was moving
sure.
furniture around in my house. They're much more subtle kinds of things. But these have to do with matters of faith. For example, I once asked somebody, you know, why some of this evidence wasn't being found, why we couldn't find these dead bodies, and the person said to me, that's because Satan made them disappear. Well, what is the argument?
Yeah, how do you argue that?
I can't argue with that. No. I mean, if that's what you... And then somebody else told me that the mistake I was making as I was looking for a horizontal conspiracy, and that is finding evidence that all these people network with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, yeah, that's what I was looking for. They said, no, this is a vertical conspiracy. And I said, what's that? And he said, all these people, the commonality is all these people communicate with Satan.
Uh-huh.
And I said, well, okay.
And
now, you know, again, I'm not saying this I'm not trying to make fun of anybody's spiritual belief system, but I have no answer to that.
No, again, from an investigational point of view, how do you move forward with that sort of rebuttal?
Exactly right. So these people never met each other, never talked to each other, but each of them talked to Satan, and Satan has been giving them instructions on what to do. Well, at that point, that doesn't serve any purpose in a criminal investigation.
Ken Lanning, thank you very, very much for your time today.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Again, Ken Lanning, former FBI agent, 30 years, folks. This gentleman knows what he's talking about. A lot of articles online for you to read that he has been a part of. Fascinating stuff, and I wanted to bring that to you today since Halloween was yesterday, and I grew up in the 80s when the evangelicals were all in a tizzy about the satanic ritual abuse stuff. So, listen, a short break. When we come back, we're going to get into the Council of Many. And this week on the Council of Many, a man wants to know if anyone has ever encountered any form of supernatural evil, like demons, etc. Not just people claiming to be evil, but a real, live, genuine encounter with evil spirits. Has anybody out there in Radio Land experienced that kind of stuff? I'd like to, a little survey, all right? 905-338-1250. 905-338-1250. The lines are open right now. Give us a call. We'll come back with your calls right after this. And then at 3 o'clock, John Ali, a.k.a. Lord Egan from the First Church of Satan. We'll be right back.
Over 100 countries listening, and the UN doesn't even know we exist. But you do. Call now, 905-338-1250.